Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half hour or so, we're going to take a look at yet more, or still more, I should say, developments with regard to the, as I speak, on June 13th of 1999, recently concluded conflict in Kosovo / Yugoslavia. This weekend, the world got something of a start when a Soviet armored column that had been part of the peacekeeping force in Bosnia suddenly cut into Kosovo and moved into Pristina and, among other things, apparently occupied the airport. This has caused quite a bit of consternation, and I personally do not think that it was the mistake that we're told it was. Rather, I think this was sort of a studied Russian answer to the allegedly mistaken bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, which I don't believe was an accident either. China had been handling diplomatic communications between Yugoslavia and the United States because Yugoslavia had broken off diplomatic relations when the bombing began on March 24th. And I simply do not believe that in the age of the Internet that was an accident. American military attachés had attended functions at that building. And I don't buy the cover story, and most other people didn't buy it either, at least not around the world. And I am of the opinion that this alleged mistake was not a mistake either, but rather I think it was a studied answer to NATO and to the United States. Russia is certainly very much weakened, but they are not Yugoslavia, and they still have nuclear weapons, and they've had their noses rubbed in the dirt, and I think this was sort of a studied chessman's response to the allegedly mistaken U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy. And I also think that the move may, it depends, we'll never know for sure, may have prevented a lot of Serbs from being slaughtered. It remains to be seen whether the KLA would have conducted such hostilities. In any event, Russians are known as chess players, and during the course of the bombing of Yugoslavia, there has been a move, or a shuffle, I should say, in the Russian government. And I'm of the opinion that this particular shuffle, I'm certainly not alone in this, this particular shuffle may very well have been in the keeping of Russian chess strategy. Research credit on this goes to a listener who got this off of the website of the Consortium. That's a group of journalists and researchers headed up by Robert Perry, last name P-A-R-R-Y. And this is dated May 24th of 1999. And this is on the website of the Consortium. And it actually appears this went up on the website on May 14th. Of 1999. So the date is 5/14. The website for the consortium is www.consortiumnews.com. Consortium News is one word, C-O-N-S-O-R-T-I-U-M-N-E-W-S. One word. Again, www.consortiumnews.com. This is by Robert Perry. It's headlined, Russia's Prime Minister and October Surprise. And this concerns Yeltsin's appointment of Prime Minister Sergei V. Stepashin, S-T-E-P-A-S-H-I-N. I may be mispronouncing that. It was Stepashin who had overseen the investigation on the part of the former Soviet Union into what has become known as the October Surprise, something of a misnomer. This was a fear held by the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980. That the Democratic President Jimmy Carter would clinch an election victory in 1980 by getting the hostages being held from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran free before election. It was feared that in October, right before the election, something would be done by Jimmy Carter. In popular usage, the term October Surprise has actually come to apply to the dilly-dallying between the Republicans and the Iranians in order to see to it that the hostages were not released until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and election defeat were assured. In fact, the October Surprise story goes way beyond what even most researchers have gone into. The heroic and landmark research of Farah Mansour, a researcher and member of the Iranian resistance, has in fact indicated that the Islamic fundamentalist movement in Iran per se, as well as the taking of the hostages, not just their withholding until after the election, but the actual taking of the hostages was deliberately arranged as part of a means of replacing the Shah of Iran as an anti-communist bulwark on the southern flank of the former Soviet Union. Although anti-American, the Islamic fundamentalists in Iran were bitterly anti-Soviet as well. Just how effective that sort of bitterness could be was proved in the Afghan War. So please note that the new Russian Prime Minister, Sergei Stepashin, had not only investigated the Republican treason in dealing with the Iranians in order to get Jimmy Carter defeated, because treason is what it was, but he reviewed Soviet intelligence files and concluded that, in fact, yes, there was massive collusion and massive treason. Robert Perry speculates that, in fact, there may have been some arm-twisting and or blackmail going on the part of the Soviets and Russians. One has to wonder whether something like that is still going on. In any event, once again, from May 14th of 1999 on the Consortium website, Russia's Prime Minister and October Surprise, it's by Robert Perry, and it reads as follows. On May 12th, U.S. reporters rushed out stories about Russia's new Prime Minister-designate Sergei V. Stepashin and the new crisis confronting Russia's democracy. But the reporters didn't mention Stepashin's role in a troubling chapter of American lost history, an omission suggesting that Russia is not the only democracy in trouble. In 1992 and 3, as chairman of the Supreme Soviet's Committee on Defense and Security Issues, Stepashin oversaw an official investigation into what Moscow's intelligence files revealed about Republican secret activities in 1980 aimed at undercutting President Carter's desperate efforts to free 52 American hostages held in Iran. The long-simmering allegations of Republican sabotage were known as the October Surprise controversy, named after GOP suspicions that Carter was hoping to free the hostages right before the November elections. Instead, according to a variety of Iranian officials and foreign intelligence operatives, Republican emissaries led by Ronald Reagan's campaign director William J. Casey negotiated a secret deal to delay the hostages' freedom. The hostages were freed on January 20, 1981, minutes after Reagan was sworn in. Stepashin undertook the review of Russia's intelligence files at the request of Representative Lee Hamilton, Democrat of Indiana, who was head of a congressional task force assigned to examine the controversy in 1992. Hamilton sent Stepashin the request on October 21, 1992, presumably because some members of the bipartisan House task force suspected that the October Surprise story may have originated as Soviet disinformation. By fall of 1992, under pressure from then-President George Bush and other Republicans, note that Bush was president, was pressuring this committee at this point. He was, of course, president, and as we will see, and as we've seen in our past examinations of the October Surprise, George Bush was centrally involved in these shenanigans, and shenanigans is really not the right word. This was outright treason and subversion of the American democratic process. By fall of 1992, under pressure from then-President George Bush and other Republicans, Hamilton already had settled on a finding that there was no credible evidence, unquote, to support the charges that the Reagan-Bush campaign had sabotaged Carter's hostage negotiations. But on January 11, 1993, just 2 days before Hamilton was scheduled to announce his conclusions, Stepashin reported back with the results of his internal Russian investigation. Translated by the U.S. Embassy in Moscow and forwarded to Congress, Stepashin's six-page report stated that Moscow possessed detailed information about secret initiatives undertaken by the Reagan-Bush campaign to negotiate a delay in the hostages' freedom. Stepashin's findings implicated George Bush, Ronald Reagan, William Casey, and Robert Gates in the pre-election machinations. Quote, William Casey, later, by the way, CIA director, in 1980 met three times with representatives of the Iranian leadership, unquote, Stepashin's report read. Again quoting, the meetings took place in Madrid and Paris, unquote. At the Paris meeting in October of 1980, quote, Robert Gates, at that time a staffer of the National Security Council in the administration of Jimmy Carter, and former CIA director George Bush also took part. In Madrid and Paris, the representatives of Ronald Reagan and the Iranian leadership discussed the question of possibly delaying the release of 52 hostages from the staff of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. Unquote. Stepashin's report also described President Carter's secret offers to Iran. One key meeting occurred in Athens in July of 1980, with Pentagon representatives agreeing, quote, in principle, unquote, to deliver, again quoting, a significant quantity of spare parts for F-4 and F-5 aircraft, and also M-60 tanks via Turkey, unquote, according to Stepashin's report. In return, Iranians, quote, discussed a possible step-by-step normalization of Iranian-American relations and the provision of support for President Carter in the election campaign via the release of American hostages, unquote. Stepashin wrote matter-of-factly about this geopolitical bartering. He observed that both the Reagan campaign and the Carter administration, quote, started with the proposition that Iran's leader Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, having announced a policy of, quote, neither West nor the East, unquote, and cursing the American devil, imperialism, and Zionism, was forced to acquire American weapons, spares, and military supplies by any and all possible means, unquote. The Republicans just won the bidding war. Nevertheless, President Carter had the constitutional authority to conduct negotiations with foreign powers. The Republican campaign did not. This is an important point. Repeating, nevertheless, President Carter had the constitutional authority to conduct negotiations with foreign powers. The Republican campaign did not. Stepashin also described how the Reagan administration fulfilled its debt to Iran. Quote, after the victory of Ronald Reagan in the election in early 1981, a secret agreement was reached in London in accord with which Iran released the American hostages and the U.S. continued to supply arms, spares, and military supplies for the Iranian army, unquote, Stepashin wrote. The deliveries were carried out by Israel, often through private arms dealers, as reports said. Spares for F-14 fighters and other military equipment went to Iran from Israel in March through April of 1981, and the arms pipeline stayed open into the mid-1980s. Through the Israeli conduit, Iran in 1983 brought surface-to-surface missiles of the Lance class plus artillery of a total value of $135 million. This is actually a misprint. It should have been bought. Surface-to-surface missiles of the Lance class plus artillery of a total value of $135 million, unquote, Stepashin's report said. Again quoting from the report. In July 1983, a group of specialists from the firm Lockheed went to Iran on English passports to repair the navigation systems and other electronic components on American-produced planes, unquote. The tap for Iranian-bound arms opened wider in 1985 with the Iran-Contra shipments. Stepashin's report matched other information that the House Task Force possessed. The Israelis indeed had shipped U.S. military spares to Iran in the early 1980s, with the acquiescence of senior Reagan administration officials. But the task force finessed the evidence of secret Reagan-approved arms shipments in the early 1980s by arguing that the deliveries did not prove a quid pro quo, unquote, dating back to 1980. Hamilton's task force also had received multiple corroboration about October surprise meetings from senior Iranian officials, French intelligence officers, and intelligence operatives from Israel and other Middle East nations. Since then, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has admitted to former President Carter that Republicans also approached the Palestinian Liberation or the Palestine Liberation Organization with a plan to delay the hostages' release. Still, the House Task Force rejected the October surprise charges, accepting the denials and strained alibis of senior Republicans, including President Bush, who was running for vice president in 1980 and was seeking re-election as president during the task force investigation. By early January of 1993, Hamilton had shipped the dismissive findings to the government printing office. The task force report was slated for release on January 13th. So the arrival of Stepashin's report on January 11th added a new complication. The 2 days offered inadequate time for any serious examination of the Russian material. The record shows only that a U.S. Embassy political officer was dispatched to press the Russians for more details. The Russians stood by their report, but would not divulge the intelligence sources and methods. They simply declared that the information came from Stepashin's Committee on Defense and Security Issues, roughly the equivalent of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Offering Hamilton a possible way out, the U.S. Embassy officer speculated that Moscow's report might be, quote, based largely on material that has previously appeared in the Western media, unquote. Though supported by no evidence, the embassy speculation was included in the confidential, unquote, cable to Hamilton. The suggestion was quietly accepted by the task force. Still nearly as serious as the October surprise charge was the fact that the Russians were claiming that they held sensitive evidence implicating two U.S. presidents, Reagan and Bush, and two CIA directors, Casey and Gates, in serious crimes of state. That last sentence again. Still nearly as serious as the October surprise charge was the fact that the Russians were claiming that they held sensitive evidence implicating two U.S. presidents, Reagan and Bush, and two CIA directors, Casey and Gates, in serious crimes of state. If true, the Soviets were in a position to blackmail top U.S. officials for 12 years. The full October surprise story also remains politically sensitive today, given the status of Bush's son, Texas Governor George W. Bush, as the Republican front-runner for the 2000 election. But Stepashin's report did not change Hamilton's plans. On January 13, 1993, Hamilton and other task force officials announced the, quote, debunking, unquote, of the October surprise story. No one made any mention of Stepashin's report or the other evidence that contradicted the official findings. The task force simply stuck Stepashin's report into a box that was stored away with other documents from the October surprise investigation. In late 1994, nearly 2 years later, this is Robert Perry speaking, of course, I received permission to review the unclassified records from the task force. I was led to dozens of boxes stored in a former ladies' room of an obscure office off the Rayburn House office building parking garage. In the boxes, I found not only the unclassified records, but a number of secret documents that apparently had been left behind by accident. One of the classified records was the confidential embassy cable containing the translation of Stepashin's report. While a stunning example of secret U.S.-Russian cooperation in the post-Cold War era, the Stepashin report still begged the larger question of whether it was based on solid intelligence from the KGB's own sources in Europe, North America, and the Middle East, or whether it was simply blowback, unquote, from Western media reports, as the U.S. Embassy speculated. In the weeks after discovering Stepashin's report, I contacted a well-placed government source in Europe who had close ties to senior Russian officials. At my request, the source inquired through his Moscow contacts about the basis for Stepashin's report. Later, the source called me back. He said the Russians were insisting that the intelligence was their own and that the information was reliable. The source chuckled at the notion that the Russians would just repackage some Western news clips and palm them off on Congress. Noting the Russian need for U.S. financial assistance in early 1993, the source added that the Russians, quote, would not send something like this to the U.S. Congress at that time if it was BS, unquote. Instead, the Russians considered the Stepashin report a bomb and, quote, couldn't believe it was ignored, unquote. Little did the Russians know that not only did the House Task Force ignore the Stepashin report, but actually stuck it in a box that was piled unceremoniously on the floor of a former ladies' room off a congressional parking garage. With President Boris Yeltsin's decision to appoint Stepashin as Russian Prime Minister, the Stepashin report is relevant again today. Yes, indeedy it is, and it'll be interesting to see just exactly what plays out in what's left of Yugoslavia. It certainly was an interesting bit of theatrics that took place this weekend, and again, I think a knowing observer could allow him or herself a little bit of a chuckle at the Russian claim that this was an accident. I see that as a direct lifting of the rhetorical middle finger to the United States, claim that they bombed the Chinese embassy accidentally, which I do not believe. Research credit on the following also goes to a listener. This comes to us from the website of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. That website is www.fair.org, FAIR again, F-A-I-R. This is from Wednesday, June 2nd of 1999. And this following was written by FAIR media analyst Seth Ackerman. And it is entitled, What Reporters Knew About Kosovo Talks But Didn't Tell. Was Rambouillet Another Tonkin Gulf? And this concerns an article in a recent issue of The Nation magazine, specifically the June 14th, 1999 issue of The Nation magazine. And this concerns allegations that some American journalists knew that, in fact, the Rambouillet proposal had been made deliberately unpalatable to the Serbs so that the Serbs would then be bombed. This article reads, New evidence has emerged confirming that the U.S. deliberately set out to thwart the Rambouillet peace talks in France in order to provide a trigger for NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia. Furthermore, correspondents from major American news organizations reportedly knew about this plan to stymie the Kosovo peace talks, but did not inform their readers or viewers. FAIR's May 14th media advisory, Forgotten Coverage of Rambouillet Negotiations, unquote, asked whether the media had given the full story on Rambouillet. News reports almost universally blamed the failure of negotiations on Serbian intransigence. The headline over a New York Times dispatch from Belgrade on March 24th, the first day of the bombing, read, quote, U.S. negotiators depart frustrated by Milosevic's hard line, unquote. But the evidence presented in forgotten coverage suggested that it was U.S. negotiators, not the Serbs, who blocked the agreement. Now, in the June 14th issue of The Nation, George Kenney, a former State Department Yugoslavia desk officer, reports, quote, an unimpeachable press source who regularly travels with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright told this writer that swearing reporters to deep background confidentiality at the Rambouillet talks, a senior State Department official had bragged that the United States, quote, deliberately set the bar higher than the Serbs could accept, unquote. The Serbs needed, according to the official, a little bombing to see reason, unquote. In other words, the plan for Kosovo autonomy drafted by State Department officials was intentionally crafted to provoke a rejection from Serb negotiators. In his Nation article, Kenny compares this plan to the Gulf of Tonkin incident. By the way, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, for the benefit of younger listeners who may not remember this or have not studied it in school, was an alleged attack by North Vietnamese patrol boats on U.S. destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of Vietnam. This was the excuse for Congress passing the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which opened the door for President Johnson to conduct the buildup of U.S. forces in Vietnam that was attendant upon the Vietnam War. And it turned out eventually that the Gulf of Tonkin attack never occurred. It was a fraud. Some scores of thousands of American deaths and millions of Vietnamese deaths later. Continuing with this article, providing further confirmation of Kenny's account, Jim Jatras, J-A-T-R-A-S, a foreign policy aide to Senate Republicans, reported in a May 18th speech at the Cato Institute in Washington that he had it on, quote, good authority, unquote, that a senior administration official told media at Rambouillet under embargo, unquote, the following. We intentionally set the bar too high for the Serbs to comply. They need some bombing, and that's what they are going to get, unquote. In interviews with Fair, both Kenny and Jatras asserted that these are actual quotes transcribed by reporters who spoke with a U.S. official. They declined to give the names or affiliations of the reporters. The revelation that American reporters knew about a U.S. strategy to create a pretext for NATO's war on Yugoslavia, but did not report on it, raises serious questions about the independence of mainstream news organizations. More reporting is needed on the origins of this war, as well as the opportunities for peace that may have been overlooked. And that indeed from the website of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and that was written by Fair media analyst Seth Ackerman, and a tip of the hat on that goes to a member of the listening audience. We're going to continue with a review of recent developments vis-a-vis the former Yugoslavia. However, we're going to do that in our next half hour. What we're going to do, before we get to the next side of the tape, what I'm going to do is give you the address, etc., for Spitfire. That's the tape duplication service that stocks the various tapes that I've done over the years, not only the archive shows and the For the Record half-hour segments, but the weekly One Step Beyond shows from my home base station, KFJ-CFM, in the South San Francisco Bay Area, and tapes of many of the lectures that I've done as well. You can reach Spitfire by mail at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Once again, that's Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website. You can reach that website at www.spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. And please note that the Spitfire website is equipped with real audio, so that web surfers can access the half-hour segments going out to the stations that carry the program on the Spitfire website. There is also a duplication of the Spitfire information on the KFJC website. That is at www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org/Emory would be a good way to simplify the search. You'll want to look in the transmissions section and in public affairs. By the way, the KFJC website is also equipped with audio so that listeners can listen to the One Step Beyond show, the three-hour program I do on Sunday. I do that Sunday night, 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and is also a half hour on Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m., also Pacific Standard Time. That concludes this half hour. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.